This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. Your source for Pan-African news and world developments, I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehi Suhib. Coming up on Africa News Tonight,
many American companies are very familiar with Kenya, having been amongst the pioneer foreign investors into the East African region. So what we're trying to do is to see how we can step up that partnership, that cooperation.
That's Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta in Washington, D.C., speaking to VOA's Esther Gitui Iwart. Details next.
Also upcoming, Mozambique's municipal elections could spark a major political shift in the country. And in Uganda, politician Robert Chagulani and 11 others charged with treason have been granted bail. We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story today, Kenya's President Uhuru Kenyatta meets with President Donald Trump in the White House. High on the agenda for their talks, trade and regional security. Kenyatta sat down with VOA's Esther Gitui Iwart for an exclusive interview to talk about his goals for this visit and about the shared interests of Kenya and the United States.
Mr. President, let's talk about your meeting with President Donald Trump. What are the talks going to be centered on?
Well, the talks will largely be centered on our security cooperation, but more importantly on how to boost our trade and investment, given the fact that the United States is one of our biggest trading partners. We have had a long, solid foundation of partnership that stretches back all the way back to our independence. And I think our objective is to see how we can strengthen that, how we can deepen that for the mutual benefit of our two countries. We want to see how we can improve our trade links. We want to see how we can encourage more American investment into Kenya to take advantage of the reforms that we have made, especially over the last 4 years, but also the infrastructural development that has been put in place. And we want Americans to come and take advantage of these activities. Encourage more companies to come in to take advantage not just of the reforms and infrastructure development, but also Kenya's location. And many American companies are very familiar with Kenya, having been amongst the pioneer foreign investors into the East African region. So what we're trying to do is to see how we can step up that partnership, that cooperation, especially with the establishment or re-establishment again of direct links between Kenya and the United States.
Now, when you talk about inviting investors in Kenya as well as U.S. business people, and I'm wondering about your handshake with your former opponent, Raila Odinga, are you confident that this handshake is going to hold and the continued peace that we're seeing now is going to hold?
Indeed I am, because I am committed, and I believe that my partner in this endeavor, Raila Odinga, is also equally committed, with a recognition that politics is just about opposing ideas. It's not about enmity. We all, after all, belong to one nation, one country, Kenya. We are all one people, and it is not in the interest of any one of us to allow political differences to cause a disintegration of our country. And therefore, the onus is on us to really say that how can we ensure we create a political environment that encourages strong political discourse, that encourages positive criticism, that encourages political competition, but not at the expense of the unity of the country. So we are committed to seeing how we can work together, especially to ensure that we unite our people so that we move away from this issue of five-year cycles where every 5 years the whole country grinds to a halt as they wait to see what outcome it has. And this is where we want to take our country to, and I believe solidly that Raila Odinga is just as committed as I am. Political competition is just that. We are all Kenyans after all. We have no other country but Kenya. We have a responsibility to work together to ensure that we have a peaceful, secure nation on which to build a solid future foundation for our people.
That was Kenya's President Uhuru Kenyatta speaking with VOA's Esther Gitui Ewart.
Mozambique's municipal elections, scheduled for October, could spark a major political shift in the southern African nation. After four decades of unity, fractures within the powerful ruling party are beginning to show, and the opposition, which has yet to deactivate its armed wing, is complaining of an uneven political playing field. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
The tension and complexity of Mozambique's upcoming municipal elections can be seen by looking at the poll's highest profile contest, the mayoral race in the capital, Maputo. Last week, the Electoral Commission kicked the two top candidates for mayor off the ballot. One was the top candidate for the opposition Renamo Party, Venancio Mondlane. The other was the man many thought would be a natural choice for the ruling party, Samora Machel Jr. Machel is a son of Samora Machel, Mozambique's first president and co-founder of the powerful Frelimo Party, which has ruled the nation since 1975. But Machel Jr. says Frelimo rejected him without explanation. He is now trying to get on the ballot as an independent. Mondlane is also pushing to be reinstated. The legal process to get these men on the ballot could take weeks, and journalist and commentator Fernando Lima says he doubts it will be resolved in their favor.
They are out of the race pending a decision by the Constitutional Council to allow them to run. Having our legal bodies being strongly controlled by the political powers, I have very strong doubts that the Constitutional Council will rule in favor of the Renamo candidate and Samora Machel Jr.
Alex Vines, head of the Africa Program for think tank Chatham House, says the local polls could set the stage for national elections in 2019.
The elections, I suspect, are going to be extremely close, and therefore the authorities are nervous about this. We can already see that there are some splits within Frelimo in the run-up to the municipal elections. Look at Samora Machel Jr., for example, contending for being mayor of Maputo, that against the official Frelimo candidate. So this is interesting political times in Mozambique, for sure.
But this is no mere political contest, Lima says. Renamo fought Frelimo in a brutal 16-year civil war, and Renamo leader Afonso Tshilikama resumed hostilities in 2014. Tshilikama died suddenly in May, as he was negotiating a peace deal with the government.
We cannot forget that along with the election process, we have the peace process, which have not been concluded yet. Renamo still have their armed force in position. And if you do not manage politically the whole electoral process, yes, you can have a lot of trouble, especially coming from the Renamo side.
And so, as Mozambique prepares for this poll, much more is at stake than just the fate of 53 municipalities. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
The 12 applicants, their applications for bail is allowed. I'll set further conditions so that they don't have to wait in the courtroom. Each of them is to execute a non-cash bond in the sum of 5 million shillings.
That was Justice Stephen Mubiru in the Ugandan town of Gulu today, granting bail to lawmaker Robert Chagulani and 11 others charged with treason. Chagulani, a pop star also known as Bobby Wine, appeared in court on crutches and looked frail. Supporters say he and some of the others were beaten while jailed. The 12 defendants, including four other members of parliament, were arrested 2 weeks ago after protesters threw rocks at President Yoweri Museveni's motorcade at a by-election campaign event in Arua Municipality. The 74-year-old president has been in office since 1986. Earlier this year, Parliament passed a law that would allow him to remain in power for life. While he remains popular with many Ugandans, the opposition and human rights activists say Museveni and his supporters have become increasingly repressive in the effort to silence criticism. The New York-based TB Alliance congratulated the World Health Organization, WHO, on its recent issuance of a rapid communication to inform all stakeholders of the key implications for MDR-TB treatment regimens. The WHO's rapid communication highlights evidence on two major issues concerning the treatment of MDR-TB, tuberculosis that is resistant to several of the drugs often used to treat it. On the positive side, the research found that by prioritizing the use of existing drugs with oral treatment, significantly improves the effectiveness of treatment. On the other side lies the challenge of maintaining the resources to continue studying the best use of the drug regimens. Dr. Mel Spiegelman is president and CEO of TB Alliance. He says they are closer than ever to the time when every person with drug-resistant TB can be treated with a shorter and simpler course of therapy. He spoke with me about the positive and negative implications of the new findings.
The extremely positive communication highlights that we finally do have some new drugs in the field that could form the basis for really major transformation of the treatment of drug-resistant TB. And that's really great. So there's finally the realization that with drugs like bedaquiline and linezolid, which have not been on the forefront, let me put it that way, of the treatment of drug-resistant TB in the past, there's the realization that these are drugs that could have, and when used appropriately, a major impact on the disease, and that finally there is real movement in the search for new treatments for drug-resistant TB.
Also, what are some of the challenges that you all are facing in using these drugs as treatment of MDR-TB?
We're seeing, in terms of the work that's ongoing in the field of drug-resistant TB, is that we finally have a critical mass of new drugs in TB that if we could afford and manage to do the right studies to truly define the best regimens, the best combinations, how to use them, in what dosages, for how long, we could have major, major improvement. And by that, I would lay out the potential of having guidelines in the not-too-distant future, if we can do the right studies, that would treat drug-resistant TB, in a sense, no differently as far as duration and cost and complexity as how we treat drug-sensitive TB. And by that, I mean a maximum of about 6 months of treatment with just oral drugs once a day or so, and potentially even shorter time. To me, this rapid communication really lays the background that says we really now have the potential with new powerful drugs that we need still to learn how to use together to simplify, shorten, and make much more affordable the treatment of drug-resistant TB.
And another big concern would be the affordability and accessibility to people living in developing countries.
The basic answer is yes, they should be accessible. But like most questions, there is some devil in the detail, and we need to get into stripping away the onion, so to speak, or peeling the onion to get down to really the issues. And the issues are, number one, can we ensure that all of the new drugs are manufactured in such a way that they truly can be produced at an affordable price, and the system is such that it's willing to pay a fair, affordable, and sustainable price for new therapies, and whether that's in Africa, in Southeast Asia, anywhere around the world where TB is a major issue and the cost factor is a major issue. We really need to get the treatment of drug-resistant TB scaled up so that we're not just treating around the world 20-25% of the patients, but we're treating 90%. You know, obviously, the goal is always 100%, that nobody falls through the cracks. But we have to strengthen the systems so that, in fact, the large, large majority of patients are being treated. We have to ensure that there is a fair profit that goes to any manufacturers, because you want the manufacturers to continue manufacturing, and for that, they're not going to do it at a loss. But it has to be a fair profit that is affordable to those in need and to the countries, but yet sustainable for the manufacturers. We've seen, though, that in TB, that's feasible if we do it right.
That was Dr. Mel Spiegelman, President and CEO of TB Alliance, speaking with me from New York.
South Africa's largest agricultural organization says most of its white members are committed to helping to establish more black farmers in the country. The African National Congress, or the ANC's government, recently said it would want to amend the constitution to allow it to expropriate farmland without compensating its white owners. But the AgriSA group, which represents tens of thousands of country's white and black farmers, says such a radical move isn't necessary to achieve land reform. Darren Taylor reports from a conference in Limpopo province, where farmers, agricultural experts, government policy makers, and others gathered to discuss land reform.
AgriSA's head of land affairs, Annalise Crosby, says the ANC statement is pure politics ahead of next year's elections in South Africa. She points to a clause in the country's constitution which already allows the state to take land from a white farmer who is deemed to own the ground as a result of apartheid.
If there's, for example, a valid restitution claim on a piece of land and the farmer is simply refusing to sell at a reasonable price, government has always been in a position to expropriate that farmer, but they've for some reason taken the political decision not to exercise that power.
Crosby says politicians are using the land issue as a football because the ANC has promised people land ever since South Africa became a democracy 24 years ago. But in most cases, these promises haven't been kept. Crosby argues that white farmers aren't to blame for this. Most of the blame, she says, should fall on the government's poorly managed land reform process.
The budget has been totally inappropriate. It's been something like 0.4% of the national budget going towards land acquisition over the past 24 years.
South Africa's Deputy President David Mambuza has acknowledged a number of failings in the state's approach so far with regard to land reform. He's told a gathering of white and black farmers in Limpopo province that despite the ANC's recent statements, white farmers would never face an onslaught from their own government. Crosby says AgriSA is encouraged by this because the implications of race-based land expropriation would be disastrous.
The worst-case scenario is if people just start invading land and they just start taking the law into their own hands, you know, then that'll be absolute chaos. If government completely scraps the protection of property rights in South Africa, you know, that will be very, very serious and it will have lots of detrimental economical impacts, probably collapse our sector.
She emphasizes that many white farmers have already started to give land to black agriculturalists.
Some of the projects are quite small, just the farmer getting into a joint venture with three or four farm workers and making a success of it. And it's been an uphill battle. They'll be very open and honest about it. Then there are also restitution projects where communities got land through the restitution process, but they haven't been able to farm that land productively. And commercial partners have come in and assisted the communities to actually start reaping the economic benefit of the land that they've received through restitution.
AgriSA and many black farmers agree that the biggest obstacle to land reform is not resistance from white farmers. It's lack of the promised government support and financing for the emerging producers and their white partners. Crosby says her organization has therefore presented a financing proposal to the state.
Our proposal is very simple. We're saying that if government is willing to subsidize the interest rates to black farmers and farm workers getting into the farming sector and put up a guarantee fund that will lessen the risk for the banks, then we'll get a lot of funding from private sector and we'll be able to do a lot more of these projects.
Crosby says the majority of white farmers love South Africa in all its diversity, and it would therefore be stupid of them to jeopardize their country's future. She adds that the more successful black farmers there are, the greater the chance of reducing the racial inequalities that persist in South Africa. I'm Darren Taylor for VOA News in Bela Bela, South Africa.
Violence against women and girls is endemic in Zimbabwe. Government figures show that at least 68% of women have suffered from gender-based violence from men. Despite laws, policies, and protocols to promote women's advancement, women are beaten and sometimes killed by their partners, while young girls are married off against their will. One young filmmaker is taking on the challenge of getting the message through to men that they do not need to harm the women in their lives. Correspondent Addie Gondo has more on the story.
Conversations with Our Fathers is an advocacy campaign calling for men to help create safe spaces for women and girls, starting at home where family violence can be high. The project is a collaboration by six Zimbabwean young leaders who received training from the United States Department of State. Among them are Yvonne Jila, Karen Mkwasi, Sizakele Mkwedini, Sizwile Nyamande, Moses Semwayo, and Thomas Sitole. A short film based on positive fatherhood entitled Mkanya was directed by Sizakele Mkwedini. The young film director speaks on the film from Canada, where she is attending the Habari Film Festival in Toronto.
The impact so far has been overwhelming because we use this film as a tool to engage communities. So far we've screened in Bulawayo, we've screened in Mbare, we've screened in Mutare. Currently I am in Toronto, Canada, screening the film as well. I just screened it at the just ended Habari Africa Festival, where it was well received. The attendance was really good, and even the engagement we had afterwards, because we could relate so well, because here they also have a lot of immigrants, Jamaican and Somali immigrants, Caribbean and Somali immigrants, who also have a lot of absent fathers, and their children end up engaged in gang violence and also a lot of domestic violence against, and it's always the women and the children that are on the receiving end of that. They really appreciated the film, as it really reflects Africa, where we are and where we could go, if we start.
The film follows the journey of redemption for the protagonist, Mkanya. It opens with his returning to the village after being retrenched from work. He is an abusive and violent father in his 50s, who is also a menace to the village. He abuses his wife without remorse until he gets in trouble with the law. At this point, he changes to become a better man, father and husband. Part of the film follows his efforts to resolve a case involving abuse against his daughter-in-law by his own son. Siza Mkwedini sees the film as a tool for social transformation that will likely be popular in worldwide film festivals.
We've also had quite a lot of requests to screen the film in communities, that through support from embassies and also through festivals. We're actually going to showcase it both the International Images Film Festival, the Women's Festival in Zimbabwe, as well as the Zimbabwe International Film Festival. We'll be screening at both local festivals. We are also being invited to the Mama Africa Film Festival in Kenya. We've also been invited to the Africa on Screen Festival in Australia, and so that they also use the film as a tool for engagement, because now the focus is on family. So we also have had support from different partners coming in, like your support from the Men Engage Zimbabwe chapter, Men Engage Africa. Some of the key things that we're coming out with that there's no support for us as men.
The film is set to be showcased in different places and platforms to encourage conversation around the benefits of involved fatherhood for women and girls. The producers hope to document the audience's views and perceptions on the topic and explore how it can advance women's rights. They hope to share the information in future initiatives that could help end violence and abuse. Reporting for VOA, this is Addie Gondo.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis, and thanks for choosing the VOA.
VOAAfrica.com. On voaafrica.com, the news updates never stop. Our primary goal is to keep you informed.
voaafrica.com, your trusted source for news and information.